Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Lenin Lives by Christopher Reed, read by Mike Cooper. Introduction. 100 years after his death, is there anything worth salvaging from Lenin's political ideas and activities in the light of, among other things, the wreckage of his main project, the Soviet Union, and the retreat of Leninist communism from its mid-20th century high points? A defining difference between Lenin and liberals and social democrats who seek greater social justice in the world is the question of violence. The latter group look to and expect to achieve their objectives peacefully by liberal democratic means. While hating violence, Lenin's view of it was more pessimistic, in that deeply entwined in Lenin's political actions, analyses, and philosophy is the assumption that those who exercise power and own and control property will, in many cases, not give up their privileges without violence. Therefore, the party that seeks social justice, redistribution, and real equality before the law must be prepared for violence. It should be made clear from the outset that Lenin detested violence and was deeply horrified by the mass slaughter of the First World War, but he was convinced that no matter how great the electoral majority, the rich and powerful would not hand over their privileges and property quietly. Many, though by no means all, historical situations in the modern world where the issue has arisen have shown that this was the case. Also, another century of liberal democracy, with social democratic intervals here and there, has not reduced but strengthened capitalism, inequality, and imperialism. The reflexive pursuit of economic growth, without which capitalism cannot function, has pushed the world to the brink of climate disaster. The Duke of Westminster remains one of the richest men in Britain, thanks to his massive land ownership that has resisted all efforts at redistribution. Oligarchs with 400-foot yachts have emerged from the wreckage of post-Soviet Russia. American billionaires can fund private space programs. That any process to exert social or community control, even over such blatant excesses of property, will only be accomplished by violence is a central challenge Lenin poses. This is not to say that his approach achieved its desired results. No one overthrew the Tsar and provisional government in order to build the Gulag, nor is it to say that Lenin is the only, or even perhaps the most important, revolutionary of our era. Starting from the assumption of fierce, violent opposition by the dominant social class, Lenin devised a number of institutions, ideas, and practices appropriate to the conditions as he perceived them. In the forefront was his idea of a democratic political party. Lenin did, from time to time, toy with the idea of a democratic path to revolution, which reminds us that, in analysing Lenin's ideas and practices, we're not dealing with an immobile, fixed system, but a dynamic set of interactions with current political conjunctures. Lenin was a brilliant analyst of successive political situations in Russia and sometimes abroad, though he was not always correct in his conclusions. No one ever is. He approached issues from different angles at different moments, but the notion that there would be a violent clash dominated his outlook in and before 1917, despite occasional nods to the possibility of peaceful transition in the newly fledged Soviets of that year. Lenin would nonetheless be shocked to be thought of as anything other than a democrat. First and foremost, his whole activity was geared to the unarguably democratic task of liberating the exploited workers and peasants of Russia and the world. However, in Russian conditions of autocratic dictatorship, he was clear this could not be done in a parliamentary fashion. To do that, one would at least need a parliament. Russia's Duma was far from that. But even so, it was the case that, like the Liberal Cadet Party, the mainly peasant-oriented Socialist Revolutionary Party and both wings of the worker-facing Social Democratic Party, including Lenin's Bolshevik supporters and the Menshevik wing, all put the convening of a constituent assembly to create a constitution as the first item in the party programme. However, Lenin's major contribution to democracy, as he and his followers understood it, was to establish a very different idea of democracy. Instead of an open political organisation, which anyone could join, Lenin made his political name by calling for a party of professional revolutionaries, organised, like its populist predecessor of the 1870s, on a cell basis. This was done to protect it from deep incursions by the Tsarist political police, since at the time this model emerged, in 1903, all political parties were illegal in Russia. Argument about it was an important, but not the only, cause of the party splitting into bickering Menshevik and Bolshevik wings. For better or worse, the Leninist model became very influential after 1917, and many, but not all, communist parties all over the globe adopted it, irrespective of local situations. In the debates around the model, Lenin presented it as a way of progressing towards a more conventional democracy, which was suitable for Tsarist conditions, not as the universal model which it evolved into after 1917. In outlining his plans, he makes it clear that, here and further on, I of course refer only to absolutist Russia. Trades unions should have as broad a membership as possible, but, on the other hand, the organisation of the revolutionaries must consist first and foremost of people who make revolutionary activity their profession. Such an organisation must perforce not be very extensive and must be as secret as possible. He reiterates the point a few pages later. The problem of a broad organisation would be that, while it is supposedly most accessible to the masses, it is actually most accessible to the gendarmes and makes revolutionaries most accessible to the police. Despite Lenin pointing out his prescription was for Tsarist Russia's specific ailments, the basic elements of Lenin's party structure became a supposed medicine for many other types of sick polity and remained a distinctive feature of Leninism. The issues of unavoidable violence and party structure led to two other related issues. First, the question of party discipline based around the concept of democratic centralism, and second, though Lenin always denied this was what he had done, revolution from above as proposed by the 19th century French socialist Louis-Auguste Blanqui. Democratic centralism had three key components. First, in theory, free discussion of political issues was permitted within the party. Second, there was a clear hierarchy stretching from local party cells via regional and other bodies to the party central committee. The highest institution in the party was the party congress, which before 1917 could only be held in secret, whether in the Russian Empire, like its founding conference in Minsk, or abroad. Wherever it took place, the secret police would attempt to infiltrate it. Congresses and less authoritative conferences were held in Brussels, London, Stockholm, Prague, and elsewhere. Motions for discussion could be passed up the hierarchy, but once they were decided upon, at central committee or congress level, the third component kicked in. All such decisions were binding on all members, and dissent could lead to expulsion. In the complex situation before 1917, when many leaders were in exile abroad, in judicial exile in Siberia, or in and out of regional prisons, this model was very fluid. After 1917, and especially at the 10th Party Congress in 1921, it was firmed up to give almost complete authority to the leadership in the name of a much more centralized conception of dictatorship of the proletariat and, even more foreboding, the voluntary option of a one-party state. The second issue, revolution from above, was a logical outcome from the other issues we've been looking at. Without going into the precise complexities of the October Revolution at this point, suffice it to say that the outcome was a Bolshevik government led by Lenin, which was essentially in a minority, not least because Russia was a country in which over 80% of the population were peasants, a class having no future in the Bolshevik scheme of things. Only by temporarily stealing the populist socialist revolutionary party's policy of handing land to the peasants did they get the brief support of this class in 1917. However one cuts it, when the Bolsheviks came to power, very few people, even hundreds rather than thousands, had any idea of what they ultimately stood for. Immediate policies and slogans, like land to the peasants, power to the Soviets, and so on, had extensive traction, but they were not the key Bolshevik aims. Ultimately, Lenin stood for a world proletarian, working-class revolution, which, as analysed by Marx, would destroy capitalism and imperialism and usher in a perfect society. Lenin's response to the task of building the socialist order was to construct it from the minority who knew what the aims were, who would pass on that awareness in a process of raising the consciousness of the workers and peasants. The Bolsheviks, and Leninists in general, did not see their task to be the implementation of the wishes of the workers. Indeed, for Lenin, this was a political heresy known as Khvostism, meaning tailism, hanging on to the tail of the labour movement rather than leading it to emancipation. The party, comprising those with a raised consciousness, believed it was up to them to lead the workers to liberation, to have the workers fulfil the schemes of the mostly intelligentsia party leaders, not the other way around. This was a Confucian approach to revolution. The master had the authority, the pupils learned from him. Schools do not run by students voting on the subject matter they are being taught. The rules of grammar or of physics are what they are. In the Leninist schema, the role of the enlightened was to lead. Though Lenin and his followers objected strongly, it is hard not to see a form of elitism at work here. Elitism cuts across democracy. Some within the party, and many beyond in the non-Bolshevik left, argued that the contradiction could be reconciled by winning over the masses first. Lenin's practice was to win them over after the seizure of power, leading to a revolutionary elite trying to create the preconditions which, in a straightforward reading of Marx, were supposed to be necessary to bring them to power in the first place. A main consequence of this back-to-front approach to Marxist revolution was the rapid emergence of productionism, the effort to maximize economic output as the central task of party and state. This happened because mass productive potential and a large working class were the foundation of any Marxist-inspired transition to socialism and communism. Lenin, needless to say, vigorously defended conducting revolution in this way. His critics argued that this process led only to premature revolution, that is, one which arrived before the circumstances needed for its success were in place, and they predicted failure. It is worth noting that one of the most influential Marxists of the 20th century, the Italian revolutionary and anti-fascist Antonio Gramsci, proposed that gaining intellectual hegemony, for instance by raising the workers' consciousness, should be the primary focus of revolutionary activity before taking power. Leninists, of whom Gramsci was essentially one in his admiration for the Russian Revolution, argued that this was naive. The ruling class held all the intellectual and cultural cards and could fatally interrupt the process of forming radical class consciousness with ruthless efficiency. From ancient tactics of bread and circuses or divide and rule, through to contemporary mechanisms like control of education, the media, political systems and the legal system, ruling classes, and one does not have to resort to notions of conspiracy theory here, can ensure that their interests will prevail and the masses will have the utmost difficulty in forming their own class identity. Instead, in Marxist terms, the non-ruling classes will be imbued with the supposed universal values of patriotism, liberal freedom, national interest, property, and other constructs behind which lurk the values and interests not of society as a whole, but of its dominant members. There were many other characteristic features of Lenin's theories and practice, and particularly their legacy and impact, but perhaps three more need to be pointed out before we move into a more detailed consideration of them. They are the question of imperialism, which, perhaps surprisingly, is closely linked to the second issue of Leninism, communism becoming attractive to peasant rather than worker activists around the globe, and thirdly, Lenin's deeply entrenched hostility to all forms of religion and the metaphysical supernatural. Most of Lenin's writings are closely linked to the immediate circumstances of Russian radical politics. Imperialism, the highest state of capitalism, is an example. Written in 1915, in the heat of the First World War, it was, for Lenin, a refutation of the ideas of a group called the Economists and others, who argued that Russia was insufficiently capitalist to have a Marxist revolution, which therefore must lie long into the future. However, although it is more about monopoly capitalism and big banks and the pursuit of profit triggering the war, it became a foundation, especially in the 1960s and 1970s, for many theories about the global reach of 20th century capitalism and colonialism. In a sense, this was a byproduct, since Lenin's main purpose was to show that, as Lenin's colleague and possible successor Bukharin had put it, borrowing a concept from the Bolshevik heretic Bogdanov, capitalism was a world system and could be broken at its weakest link. Since Russia was a weak link in the capitalist chain, it could be a catalyst to world revolution if a socialist revolution broke out there. It circumvented the argument that Russian capitalism was too underdeveloped to allow the idea of a Marxist revolution, which, according to Marx, was to be expected only when capitalism had overdeveloped itself into exhaustion. Russia was only just over the threshold of capitalism, not at the exit door, but if it set off a revolution that spread to the advanced countries, then they could help Russia advance rapidly to socialism. In a second irony, it was the notion of Soviet Russia as an anti-imperialist power that attracted colonial and Third World revolutionaries to it. Soviet Marxism, and the example it became of a country industrializing itself by a non-capitalist and non-imperialist route, attracted attention in the pre-industrial parts of the world as well as in the advanced capitalist countries. The outcome was that no revolutions, apart from the largely fake versions exported to Eastern Europe after 1945, occurred in primarily industrial countries. But they did come about in a number of peasant countries, notably China, Vietnam, and Cuba, where communism still holds sway. Finally, it is worth recalling that Lenin was fanatically anti-religious, far more so than Marx. Lenin frequently referred to all religions as, in Marx's words, the opium of the people, by which Lenin meant a toxic substance which poisoned humanity. He conveniently overlooked the rest of Marx's comment. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opium of the people. Writing at a time when opium smoking was widespread and legal, Marx's words meant that opium was a comforter in the soulless and heartless world of capitalism, a much more finely nuanced concept. With his emphasis on religion and the state, Lenin had a distinct similarity to Marx's Russian rival in the 1860s, the anarchist Mikhail Bakunin, for whom the chief enemies of a free humanity were God and the state. In the conditions of Russian autocracy, where the church was deeply assimilated into the oppressive autocratic state, this was an unsurprising emphasis. However, it led Leninists head-on into unnecessary battles with the religious sensibilities of the mass of their Russian peasant citizens, and to the outside world, often made them look like fanatics in their persecution of religion, a process which deeply antagonized the populations inside and outside Russia they were trying to win over. It may have made the activists feel good ideologically, but it was an unnecessary drag on revolutionary development. Indeed, many of the key points of Leninist criticism of religion were shared by many believers themselves, who criticized the clergies and hierarchies for corruption, self-interest, and exploitation. Lenin shared the common late 19th century assumption, arising from Darwin's ideas, that science and religion, mainly Christianity was assumed at that time, were incompatible. The former would replace the latter as education became more widespread and society became more rational. Clearly, in this respect, Leninism and Marxism was a child of the Enlightenment of the 17th and 18th centuries, which assumed that reason would capture more and more ground and religions would shrink into husks and wither away. Secularization would become universal. The resurgence of political religion, for better or worse, the continued dynamism and development of existing religions, and the self-evident fact that there are many prominent scientists who are religious suggests a more nuanced approach would enable Leninists to join more easily with believers fighting for social justice and cultural liberty. Indeed, in a letter, Marx himself said that his ideas had no impact on the fundamental questions of life, death, and meaning. Lenin's legacy has many more features, some of which we will encounter later, but in looking for lasting influence, the challenge of violence, the nature of the party, democratic centralism, the dictatorship of the proletariat, the top-down revolution, the concept of imperialism and anti-religious dogmatism and wider intolerance are all potential players. We will begin our investigation by looking at how they had emerged in Lenin's thinking and practice before moving on to look at how key aspects of Lenin's ideas developed within Russia and in the wider world, and finally weigh up if any of it still speaks to the 21st century situation. Perhaps the paradox of the contemporary situation is that neoliberal values and practices seem unchallenged globally in a way they have not been since before 1900, giving the contemporary centre-left a perspective of mass obstacles to the realisation of their ideas comparable to that facing Lenin. At the same time, today there are critical issues pushing humanity to the brink of disaster, even extermination. Climate change is in the forefront of the global mind today, but there are also nuclear weapons, which are little considered but may pose an even more immediate threat than global warming, as the tragic, absurd, and unnecessary war in Ukraine has reminded us in opening an unlikely but possible escalatory path to nuclear annihilation. But the list does not stop there. Ever-growing national and global inequalities, expanding flows of political and economic migrants, and finally, the environmentally driven need to move away from notions of endless expansion of material production based on assumptions of the unlimited exploitation of natural resources, constitute existential threats to modern human life. Arguably, all require socialist solutions, that is, collective, not individual decision-making, planned, not market-driven strategies, and inclusion of social justice and property rights in any initiatives to deal with them, and some form of international, global governance, or at least extensive cooperation for their resolution. It is no coincidence that climate summits in the COP series, such as Paris, Rio, Glasgow, and Sharm el-Sheikh, are sponsored by the United Nations organization and are the largest assemblies of national leaders that have ever taken place. Somehow, the contradiction between rampant neoliberal capitalism and the very survival of the species has to be resolved. Can Lenin's ideas and political practice add anything to the pot? In answering such wide-ranging questions, even in a relatively brief account such as this one, one inevitably stands as a diminutive figure on a mountain of work produced by a myriad people. I am deeply indebted to them all and greatly acknowledge the contributions of predecessors with a wide range of opinions, often very different from my own. I am writing this during the unthinkable war between Ukraine and Russia. I dedicate the book to all those, Ukrainian, Russian, and beyond, suffering from this totally unnecessary conflict, and to hope for the most rapid possible restoration of peace between the Ukrainian and Russian people and between their governments. Sadly, in the last days when I was completing this work, a great friend for 50 years, colleague and the discussant of the issues in this book, Dr. Robin Clifton, died at his home in Mid Wales. This book is also dedicated to his memory and to Vivian Clifton Jones, who will miss him even more than the rest of us. Part 1. Lenin before Leninism. Who was Lenin? There was nothing in Lenin's childhood and early adulthood to suggest he would become one of the most influential figures of the 20th century, begin the political, economic, social and cultural modernization of his country, inspire revolutions around the globe, and inspire the creation of one of the world's most powerful war machines, which would literally stop Nazism in its tracks. Still, today, Lenin is seen in China as a major source of China's own modernization. Neither he nor the Soviet system he inspired completed the building of socialism, still less communism, in Russia. It was always a work in progress. Even so, the vastness of his influence, achievements, and failures is hard to reconcile with the modesty of his beginnings. Early years. The family into which Vladimir was born on the 23rd of April 1870 was that of a moderately prosperous local teacher, headmaster, and eventually school inspector. The family name was Ulyanov. The conspiratorial pseudonym, Nikolai Lenin, came later. Oddly, the name by which he is known today, Vladimir Lenin, was a hybrid of his real and pseudonymous names and was rarely used in his lifetime. Though the familiar form, Vladimir Ilyich, Ilyich is a traditional Russian patronymic derived from his father's name, Ilya, was. He lived a comfortable middle-class life with his parents and three brothers and three sisters in the town of Simbirsk, located on the River Volga in the deepest central provinces of European Russia. A surviving photograph shows the Ulyanovs as a typical middle-class family of the time. Summers were spent on his wealthy aunt's country estate at Kukushkino. Later, he himself inherited a small estate at Alekhaivka, near another Volga city, Samara. The young Vladimir Ilyich spent some time working there, and he later recalled his mother hoped he would settle down there. How different would the world have been had he done so? We obviously cannot know, but meditating on it is one way of answering our central question about his enduring legacy. There was nothing in the young Lenin's life to suggest political involvement until the family was hit by a cataclysmic blow. Vladimir's eldest brother, Sasha, short for Alexander, a biology student at the University of St. Petersburg, was arrested in 1886 for conspiring to assassinate Tsar Alexander III. Sasha had, indeed, been part of a small group of potential bomb-makers and assassins. Altruistically, he tried to protect the other members of the group and take all the blame upon himself, but the authorities wanted to make an example of them all. Only 5 years earlier, in 1881, the current Tsar's father, Alexander II, had been assassinated. The authorities were still very nervous and not prepared to show mercy. Sasha and four other conspirators were executed on the 8th of May, 1886. The execution of the mild-mannered and gentle eldest brother changed the family, especially the surviving brothers and sisters. They all, to one degree or another, became more radicalized, but none more so than Vladimir, who was 16 at the time. Some have argued the trauma created some kind of psychological damage to the young Vladimir, but the most likely explanation is far more simple. He and the rest of the family were simply horrified, as Sasha had been, by the tyranny of the autocracy which intruded so cruelly into their lives. Even Vladimir's parents, who were God-fearing and conventional in many respects, were opposed to the prevailing conditions in Russia. Vladimir's father, Ilya, used his influence as a teacher and school inspector to do his best to bring education to the most deprived, notably village peasants. As such, he was a living example of what was known as small deeds liberalism, bringing betterment to the masses by immediate, practical, everyday actions rather than by devotion to the cataclysmic solution of general revolution. Vladimir's mother, Maria, was, in the gender-restrictive conventions of the time, less active outside the family, but for the rest of her life, that is, until the 12th of July 1916, she supported Vladimir when he needed it, as he never held down a money-earning job. The money came from the modest pension she received as a widow of a senior public servant after Ilya died in January 1886 of a vascular brain hemorrhage, possibly exacerbated by anxiety over Sasha's imprisonment and trial. Despite the trauma of losing his father and beloved brother within a few months, there was no reason to expect Vladimir to become the figure he later was. From scanty sources, we can piece together that Vladimir's dormant political instincts were aroused by curiosity about what his brother had been secretly doing. Why did he sacrifice his life? The answer was not hard to find. At his trial, Sasha spoke out against political and social repression and in support of the downtrodden peasantry. He associated himself quite clearly with the peasant-facing narodnik, populist tendency among the revolutionary intelligentsia in Russia. The term is completely distinct from its predominant 21st-century meaning of irrational, demagogic right-winger. Vladimir seems to have also been partly radicalized by starting to read political books and pamphlets from Sasha's collection. This may or may not have included the well-known novel What Is to Be Done, published in 1863 by one of the founding fathers of populist ideology, Nikolai Chernyshevsky. Central to the book's message, and to Sasha's short, heroic life, was the notion that it was the duty of the privileged intellectual to use her or his talents in the service of the oppressed. We have good evidence that Vladimir was heavily influenced by this book. He's quoted by one of his early political acquaintances as having said that reading What Is to Be Done ploughed him over and recast his mind in a new form. It was in 1888 that this first encounter happened. It does imply that Vladimir's first political affiliation was as a populist. Vladimir's early political awakening and other radicalizing experiences were linked to his brother and father's fate, not in a morbid or psychotic way, but out of admiration for and association with what he stood for. His brother's shadow also loomed over the young Vladimir's position in society, thanks no doubt to lobbying by his head teacher, ironically the father of Alexander Kerensky, the prime minister overthrown by Lenin in 1917, and his stellar school results, also ironically including top marks in religious studies, he was admitted to the local university in Kazan.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?